You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, this is Dori Berenstein, and you are listening to Deep Dive Broadway, the podcast that takes you on an immersive adventure inside the creation of Broadway shows with the visionary directors, creators, producers, and stars that bring these shows to life. I've been producing Broadway shows for over 25 years and love more than anything the show behind the curtain. There's nothing like it. I'm thrilled to kick off episode one of Deep Dive Broadway with a look inside the creation of the 2019 Tony-winning revival of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. Joining me today are incredible artists from the show. Please welcome Tony-nominated director Daniel Fish, Tony-nominated star Mary Testa, who stars as Aunt Eller, actor James Davis, who stars as Will Parker, Nathan Cosey, Oklahoma's music director, and the producer of the Tony-winning show, Eva Price. Let's dive in. Just to start, I want to quote Ben Brantley because I just am obsessed with this quote. He said, "How is it that the coolest new show on Broadway in 2019 is a 1943 musical usually regarded as a very square slice of American pie?" It is so far from square. It is cutting edge, beautiful, simple, but unbelievably impactful. And so let's get a little context. So Daniel, if you could set the scene, because I believe in 2006 with Joanne Acolytis, she came to you and said, I want you to do a show.
Joanne was running the theater department at Bard College, and she said, "I want you to come do something with the students here." And I said, I don't really know why I said this, but I said, "I want to do Oklahoma, and I want to do it as dinner theater." And Joanne, being Joanne, said yes. So I did. And I think, like a lot of people, I thought I knew Oklahoma. You know, that it's a show whose music I've been listening to since I was a kid. And when I started to work on it, I thought, oh, actually, I don't know this show as well as I thought I do. And I started to see a show that I didn't know was there, and the story about community and the nature of exclusion and justice that I had no idea was in the piece. And that sort of became the heart of what I ended up working on and off for 12 years.
And so Oklahoma in the very beginning for you was a challenge. You could have said anything, I guess.
Well, I mean, there must have been some reason. I mean, you know, I sort of trust my instincts. I mean, I don't think it came out of nowhere. You know, I think I probably thought about doing a production at some point and thought, well, who would let me do this? Joanne would. but it was so long ago, I can't really remember what the impulses behind it were.
And in terms of starting to shape a very different creative vision than the original production or many productions of Oklahoma that have been out there, could you talk us a little bit through how your creative vision started to take shape and you know, what from going all the way back to the Bard production remains today?
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody else asked me that recently, and a lot of that production remains today. It was set in a kind of wooden room, much smaller than the wooden room that we're in now at Circle in the Square. I think there were about 100 people in it. They were all sitting at tables, and they were all sitting around chili pots, those very same chili pots. And that really grew out of a conversation with the set designer at the time, John Conklin, and the costume designer at the time, Kay Boyce. We were kind of talking about dinner theater, and like, what is that about? What is this weird genre, dinner theater, that I think no other culture has? And is there something about people sitting down to a meal together and people going to see a play? Is there some similarity there? And I kind of just started with that question and got unpacked from there. And then once we started really looking at the text of it, I started to find out all these other things.
And after the Bard production, did you have the vision way back then that I am going to continue to work on this and day?
No. It went very well at Bard, and a number of people saw it. Gideon Lester, who at the time was running the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, saw it, and he was interested in doing it at ART as a professional production, and for a number of reasons that did not happen. Jumped to 2014, and Gideon was now running the Fisher Center at Bard, which had a summer festival, and he said, let's do it here, and let's really seriously do a professional production, let's have a new orchestration, let's have a great cast, and that really was a huge step forward, and I think the real beginnings of the production that's currently at Circle in the Square.
And so was the 2006 and 2015 production in the same space at Bard?
Yes, the very same space.
Oh my gosh.
And as many people know, Patrick Vale, who plays Judd Fry, played Judd Fry as a 20-year-old or 21-year-old senior at Bard in that production.
So Eva, you saw the production in 2015, and you immediately said, oh my gosh, could you talk about your reaction and what you did?
Yeah, sure. I had seen one production of Oklahoma previously when I was 9 years old at a very cheesy summer stock theater in New Hampshire in a barn. So I had one vision for what Oklahoma could be. So when I had gotten word about this production at the Bard Summerscape, I didn't believe that it was all these things that this casual friend had told me it had become, because I thought, well, I know this show and I know that score really well, and how could that be Oklahoma? So I went to see it at the Bard Summerscape. I remember I had to call three different people to get a ticket because it was completely sold out, because it was 200 seats at that point, and a three-week run, I think. And this was near the end of it that I went. Was completely flabbergasted the 2 hours, 45 minutes that I was in that room. I couldn't believe I was actually watching Oklahoma. I couldn't believe that this was the same text and the same score that I knew so well from being a fan of American classic musicals. And for that reason, I felt that it deserved a much wider life. And I felt like I was a little bit of a maverick producer, sort of on the younger side, kind of newer. The things I was interested in doing were a little more edgy and innovative, and I thought, well, I think I'm the right person for this, and I'm willing to not bring it to Broadway if that's what the world wants. If it's not meant to be there, that's also fine. I'll still figure out a way to get it seen by more people and more people. So it was through then a series of many, many phone calls, many, many meetings. There was a chance train ride from Chicago to Milwaukee that we don't need to get into today, that Ted Chapin was also on. And I eventually was able to help everyone over at the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization see that this production was meant for greener pastures. And that eventually led to the St. Anne's Warehouse production, which again, we did not have the rights for Broadway, but I just had faith, and my gut told me that if we can get it right and make it inevitable in Brooklyn, we will make it inevitable for Broadway, and more things will even be possible from that. And here we are.
What extraordinary producing vision. But, you know, it is so remarkable because I think the script is intact, and the score is, you know, it's quite true to the original arrangements, but it's so different. It's so different. It's just, it reveals so much more than you even realized when you first saw the production or saw the film.
And who knew, or maybe you did, that it would be ridiculously timely and just kind of bring up subjects that are so important in the world we're living in today, whether or not it's bullying or gun violence. And, you know, when you saw it, I would imagine that these issues resonated in such a huge way for you.
Well, what's really interesting about that point, actually, so it was summer of 2015. Obama was still president. Hamilton had not appeared on Broadway yet, but had had its run at the Public.
Marriage
right?
Equality had just passed.
Marriage Equality had just passed. The world was changing. There was an urgency. Gun violence was a problem that had, unfortunately, had never gone away. The idea of an outsider was a thing. The idea of a community being culpable for something and everyone being in something together was a thing. But I remember quite distinctly a year later, summer of 2016, while I was still working to get the rights to the show and get it to New York, Brexit happened. And we had yet to have had our 2016 election where more things fell apart in this country. But Brexit was sort of the first instinct that outsiders and the idea of xenophobia and the idea of being afraid of things that are different could drive political change. That was sort of the first moment that the world was falling apart. And I remember talking to the artistic director of the Bard Summerscape, who together we were working to further the show's life. He said, "I think Brexit's good for the show." I said, "I think, unfortunately, you're right." And as we know, the world continued to change, making the show even more relevant and more impactful.
And more urgent.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but I think, you know, one of the things about the theater is it's always about the moment that it's happening in. So I mean, I think in some ways it's fair to say that the show is, you know, like it's a sort of, you know, synchronistic combination of the show and the time. But the fact is, I think if we're doing our job, any play, any show we do is going to be about the moment that we're working in, so that we're living in. So, you know, in 2015, Obama was president, and with that line, "The country's a change and got to change with it," had a kind of, you know, very positive, you know, resonance. You know, skip to now, and we have a sociopathic moron running the country, and that line means something very different.
As does mob mentality and, you know, everything else that comes out.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Mary, when did you get involved, and what was it about hearing about it, or you that just made it something that you had to do?
Well, I had worked with Daniel. He had to remind me because I forget everything, on a reading with a mutual friend of ours, Polly Penn, of a musical. We had done like a week reading or a 2 week reading, and he called me and asked me to do this, and I sort of had to be reminded And I just thought, oh, it sounds interesting. I'm kind of like a pinball, whatever I hit up against, I do. So I thought, oh, this sounds interesting, because we worked on around a table for a week or 2 weeks at New York Theater Workshop, just looking at the script. So I thought, that's cool. So that's how I became involved.
And, you know, you're known for your brilliant comedy, but also your serious roles. And it's such a perfect amalgamation of everything that you do.
Thanks.
You know, it's, and I love that Aunt Eller is such a fierce woman that is an inspiration.
Well, thank you. Everybody. That's awfully nice.
But, you know, how did you find the truth in that character? What was your process?
It's just finding.
She can't not find the truth.
Thanks.
It's absolutely
no, I mean, it's just finding truth in what you're doing and saying, and relationships, and my relationship with Lori, and my relationship with Curly as the woman who is sort of on this farm with Lori, and trying to create some sort of backstory that makes sense to me with all the characters. And that's, you know, it's just, he's the type of director that does not tolerate any falseness. So it's, you know, it was fairly easy to create a reality bounced off of all the other actors who are part of this as well. Jimmy has been with it from the beginning as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's like creating any character you do. You just want to be truthful. You want to get the beats right. You want to know what you're saying, where you're going, and make it all seem real. And so that's kind of what I did. Yeah.
Jimmy, you, mm-hmm. I read that you played Will Parker in high school.
I did. And it was probably like one of my last musical that I did too.
So I want to think that Daniel saw your production in high school and had you in mind, but what really happened for you?
I remember. Do you remember what happened?
What's
your version of it? I want to hear your version.
Well, we did a reading together and of a play, and then we did a week-long workshop up at New York Theater Workshop of a David Foster Wallace piece.
Yeah.
Which we all sat at tables and had, I forget which book it was.
The Pale King.
The Pale King.
Chapter from The Pale King.
And it was very experimental, and we'd sit down and we'd just read kind of without any inflection or meaning the lines until he pointed to somebody else and said, "You continue to read." And there were about six actors, so we did that. So I knew how much he likes things to be like on the language, which is also how I work too. And then I took an 11-day road trip out to L.A. because I thought I was going to move there. And they asked me to put myself on tape for Ally Hackum, which I thought was bizarre. But, you know, I didn't know anything about this production yet. And I thought, dude, I just moved out here. Do I really want to go back to do a regional theater production of Oklahoma? And I was like, wait, Daniel's directing this. This is going to be great and insane. And, of course, you book something in New York when you go out to L.A., so it's just a sign to get out there. And we did that two-week workshop at New York Theater Workshop, and I think I was brought in as cast. And so they were throwing Ally Hackum stuff at me, Will Parker stuff at me, and I think by the end of the day, it was pretty much just all Will Parker stuff that I was doing. Yeah.
I love that.
But Nathan, what was your story?
Yeah.
I'd forgotten about the Wallace workshop. My story is sort of like that, but I remember, like, yeah, you sort of, my version is like, you were like, oh, I want to play Will Parker. I want to play Will Parker. And I was like, really?
Well, probably.
I don't think you're right for Will Parker, but you came in and then just made
this
it.
This was an internal and conversation then, you were having with yourself then, in your head.
And then you made it impossible to not play Will Parker.
I also like knew I shouldn't tell him that I played it in high school. I was like, this will come to no good if he knows that I've already done this in high school.
Nathan, you're the music director, but this is not your typical music director opportunity. You are a character in the show. You're on stage the entire time.
He's slim.
Thank you. I am
that's
slim.
That's his name, yeah.
Uh-huh. So you have a backstory in the whole thing?
Not really.
And he has no mic support.
I'm trying not to giggle. I'm trying to say my line loud enough. That's my backstory.
Nathan is pretty brilliant, I have to say.
Oh, go on.
I have to say that because I'm very impressed by you. Every day I'm more impressed by you.
Likewise, Mary.
He's pretty brilliant, yeah.
I worked with Daniel on a kind of a multimedia oratorio opera piece about Chelsea Manning called The Source that was written by a composer named Ted Hearn. And I was conducting and playing keyboards on that, which I think that's the first thing I did with Daniel. And that was a beautiful and austere piece. It involved a lot of projections and large scale human faces and the band hidden in a behind a screen. And the next email I got from Daniel was asking me if I wanted to do Oklahoma, which felt like, is this the same Daniel? Is this, are you sure? I'm not, I don't understand your sense of humor yet. So maybe this isn't, but definitely came from a very kind of experimental theater and experimental music background. But had been working in some either music directing or conducting or sometimes composing, that kind of facilitation role in theater. So I said yes, because I didn't know any better. And Daniel Kluger was already on. Kluger and Fish were both, I believe, already.
I think so, yeah.
Hatching plans, and then I was kind of brought in to music direct. And
I think your job is sort of goes beyond music direction.
Yeah,
agreed.
I think Nathan was really, you know, instrumental in rehearsals. We were figuring out what the feel of each song was going to be and how parts were going to get assigned, even because we were reassigning vocal parts as we went along. And so he was, you know, sort of instrumental in the building of the musical vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. And originally, I believe Oklahoma had 28 musicians.
Sounds
and
right.
You
right.
have seven?
Exactly.
How did you manage that?
That's a question for Daniel Kluger.
Yeah. That's a really, I admit when I first came on, you know, I knew that it was kind of a, you know, the big terms I had were kind of folk music, Oklahoma, and in my mind, I admit I was, I foresaw a world, and admittedly, kind of where I think Daniel Kluger, it's fine to call him Kluger, he's a genius in these ways that I was like, oh, this is going to be kind of a simplified, like, oh yeah, guitar and bass playing kind of like, not necessarily dumbed down, but certainly kind of folkified version of these songs, and Daniel Kluger had a much different, much more meticulous idea, which I think is what really makes another thing that makes it so good, that none of it is, just like the text, none of it is really changed even. I think he took these original Robert Russell Bennett orchestrations from the 40s that were for a big orchestra and had winds and brass and strings and harps and timpani and all manner of things, and really, you know, surgically and like carefully took, really distilled them to our instrumentation and created these parts that are really, in certain moments, very idiomatic to bluegrass music, and we're you know, the banjo sounds like a banjo in a bluegrass band, but a lot of the times also having the banjo player be the bassoon player or be the clarinet player, and these really like specific lines that aren't necessarily idiomatic initially to the instruments, but I think then kind of through all of us and the band working together kind of made them fit the instrumentation and fit the room and everything. So.
And you can hear our cast recording on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever
Indeed.
You like.
Yes.
YouTube.
And go right now. I would love for you to talk for a minute about the instrument of hope, because that is such a powerful thing that you guys did.
Absolutely. And that, I feel like that I was Eva along with Level Forward, am I correct? Mm-hmm. This amazing instrument that was sprang out of the students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, where the Parkland shooting happened, teamed up with a local brass technician who's actually my brass repair guy, Josh Landris. Beautiful guy, beautiful brass shop, built an instrument that was made, parts that were made from melted down bullet casings. And I believe the number of AK-17 casings that represent the number of deaths from that shooting. And they have, it's called Shine NSD, and they've taken this instrument through numerous performing artists and bands. And I know I saw a thing in New York where all like a 30 or 40 trumpet players in the New York studio scene got together and recorded this amazing song using the instrument and their own trumpets. So we were, I believe, the first Broadway show to feature it. After our show, we did a little arrangement of Out of My Dreams. I came up, for better or for worse, play a lot of different instruments, trumpet being one of them. So we did an arrangement after the show. And it was really, I don't know, you do these shows, you do eight a week, and you know stuff's coming up, and you know, oh, we're going to do this, and it's all really such great stuff. But I feel like Mary gave a speech before we did it.
Well, I just started crying. Yeah. Like, you know, two lines into the speech, and there were Marjorie Stoneman people in the audience, and it was very moving. And
I think there's such a contrast, too, between hearing a three-hour show where all the instruments are stringed instruments and an accordion, and then you have this powerful, bellowing trumpet. Mm. And I think it just, like, knocked everybody off of their feet.
Yeah,
and they were
special.
Conditioned to hear one type of sound. And then they heard this, like, grand, fill-the-room sort of undeniable, blunt instrument.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Yeah.
And Mary, I think your speech and then your trumpet performance, it's online.
Yeah, apparently
so
they filmed
go,
it.
So go and listen to this. You will be changed. You will be changed.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
I would imagine, this is for all of you, that there are audiences that come into the theater and they are... they've read about it, or they've heard, you know, just that this is not your old traditional Oklahoma, and that there are audience members who have they saw Oklahoma, they're going to buy a ticket. And are you aware of, like, all sorts of different audience experiences that are happening in that space?
Very much so. Yeah,
yeah, they're lit the entire time, so we see all 600 faces every night. Yeah. And it's really indiscernible to know what people are thinking. You think somebody hates something and they're stone-faced, and then you realize they've been sitting there thinking about it for 3 hours and then can't wait to tell you what they think about how profound it was to them. And, you know, I saw them during the audience and I thought they were hating it the entire time, so you never know.
We have a fair amount of people who in the last Oklahoma, after the trial scene and after all the violence, we sing Oklahoma and they clap along, and it's a little weird because they've just witnessed something really intense and violent, and then they clap along like it's a happy thing. And I've actually had twice in the autograph line young people say to me, "Do they do that all the time?" And I've said some people do, yeah, and they found it really weird. It's really an interesting dichotomy because the young people seem it really resonates with them, and then sometimes the older people want their Oklahoma the way they want their Oklahoma. They don't want to take in anything that's too brutal. So.
And that's how I define the way people live in this country and consume what happens. Like, sometimes they want to give in to the pain and to the anxiety and to the upset that is the reality. And then some people want to smile and clap and not see it. And that's America. So if that's what's happening in the encore, that's okay, because that's real life.
Thanks so much for listening to part one of our look inside the creation of the Tony-winning revival of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. There's so much more, so please join us for part two.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.